Welcome back to the program. Millions of people today are living a good part of their lives in the virtual world, in the games they play, in the work they do. What are the rules of that virtual world? What are the laws that govern so much of the action that takes place there? Are they different than what exists in the real world? And have we set up clear boundaries in terms of how that world operates? We're going to talk about all of this today with my guest, Greg Listoka. He's a professor of law at Rutgers Law School. His research has focused on intellectual property and law on the Internet. He's the author of a new book entitled Virtual Justice. Greg Listoka, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Good to have you here. First of all, when you talk about the virtual world, define a little bit what you mean by that world in terms of its rules, its laws, its operation.
My take on virtual worlds in the book is to look particularly at virtual worlds that involve avatars and simulated spaces. I think there's a broader sense in which people use the word virtual world to mean the Internet or kind of social software technologies like Facebook, anything that you're involved with that's non-tangible. But my focus in the book is largely on things like Second Life, World of Warcraft, Farmville, these kind of online spaces where people interact with each other, and there's a simulated area, space in which they have properties, and they exchange those with each other and create new things.
Given that most of this is in the context of gaming, why does it matter that we establish clear-cut rules about these things?
Well, I think even in games, there's certain rules that people obey. So if you're playing football, there's certain rules, and if somebody, after the play has stopped, is going to attack you, then that would be a violation of the rules. It would be something you'd be concerned about. Same thing with a card game. You might be playing poker, and if someone just grabs the money off the table and runs away, then that would be a violation of the game rules. And what's interesting about a lot of these online games is it's often not clear exactly what the rules are. And there are people with substantial amounts of time and money invested in these virtual worlds. So there's a question about, you know, what are the rules? Are there game rules that govern this space? Are there legal rules that step in if the game rules fail?
Are there legal rules that are applicable?
Yes, yeah, certainly. I mean, there are things you can do on any kind of platform. You can do, you can say things in a newspaper that could get you into legal trouble. So you could say the same things in a virtual world, and that could get you into trouble as well. So there are things that you can do with regard to intellectual property, with regard to fraud, and you can just use a virtual world to do those things instead. So there's laws that apply. The more interesting question, I think, with regard to virtual worlds is, if you do something like steal from another person in a virtual world, and the virtual world allows you to steal from the other person, does the law trump the game rule, or does the game rule essentially trump the law?
Another part of it would be what kind of jurisdictional authority is there and who has it?
Right. That's a problem with the Internet generally. If we are on the Internet, we might be talking with someone else, and that person might be in Australia. So what jurisdiction creates the rules with regard to our speech? If we were to say something defamatory, would that be governed by United States law or by Australian law? And I think with virtual worlds, it becomes even more pronounced as a problem in that you seem to be in the same space with someone else, and you seem to have an entire community with its own set of rules, but that community could be drawn from multiple geographic jurisdictions all around the world. So it creates a lot of jurisdictional problems, I think, for the law trying to deal with disputes arising in virtual worlds.
And what has been the framework by which these things, when they come up, begin to get addressed or adjudicated in some way?
Well, the first kind of legal threshold, I think, is the terms of service that govern any kind of online world. So if you play World of Warcraft or use Facebook and play Farmville on the Facebook platform, you have to click usually I agree button and say, I accept the terms of service and I'm governed by these rules. So the first question usually is, does the contract that you signed when you entered into this space govern your conduct inside the virtual world? And additionally, does that contract actually speak to the thing you're complaining about? So one of the problems with this, using contracts to resolve everything, you can discuss whether it's a problem or not, but most of the contracts of online world say you actually have no legal interest in anything that you acquire in the virtual world or even in continuing to use the virtual world. And at any time or, for any reason or for no reason, we can boot you out of the virtual world and confiscate all your stuff. So there was a lawsuit about that kind of provision called Bragg versus Linden Lab, where somebody was using Second Life, and Linden Lab, the owners of Second Life, said, "We're booting you out. We're confiscating your land. You did something we don't approve of, and basically terminating your service." And there was the person who was booted out because of this, Mark Bragg, an attorney, brought a lawsuit and said, "No, I actually invested thousands of dollars on your platform. You said I own that virtual land, and therefore you can't just boot me out for no reason without giving me at least a hearing on this issue."
But in fact, if the terms of service say otherwise, once you've signed them, you sign them.
Right. And that's the interesting thing about that is that the majority of people don't actually read those terms of service.
I don't know anybody that's ever read them.
Right. So if, 1% of people are reading the terms of service, and then the law says, well, those terms of service govern your actions and your rights in this space, then I think we're in an interesting legal situation, to say the least, because most of the terms of service are written, understandably, by the companies for the benefits of the companies. And I think you're seeing things with regard to people using Facebook, for instance, where people say, well, the terms of service might say you can do anything you want to with my personal information, and you own, a license to use all the things that I upload. But at a certain point, the things that you're doing might be abusive or, invasive of my my privacy, and that's just not fair. So there's an interest in, I think, getting past these kind of online contracts as the sole means of governing user rights and responsibilities in these spaces.
But, of course, if somebody hasn't read the contract, that's not the company's problem.
Right. Well, that's the standard legal rule. Right. You have the duty to read. So if you sign a contract and you say you've read it, you're going to be bound by the contract, whether you've read it or not. And I think that makes sense to some extent in the offline, world. If you are presented with a form contract and you're going to read that contract in order to determine whether or not you want to deal with this, merchant, that's it can be a workable situation, I think, when there's different people competing and they have different terms in their contracts. You're going to choose the one that's best. In the online space, I think when we're all kind of acclimated to, oh, yes, I'll just click I agree to this, I'll click I agree to this, we might not realize, I think, at the time that we sign up for a Gmail account, how important that account is going to be to our lives and, to a particular dispute that comes up in the future. And do we really want to have a system where we have the majority of people not reading these things, but these terms of service are going to govern their rights and duties, not just with respect to the companies, but with respect to each other? I think that's a problem as well.
Are we going to have to create some kind of extra legal system to deal with this world?
Well, I think to a certain extent the companies already are creating extra legal systems. So so eBay, for instance, if you have a dispute with another person on eBay with regard to a transaction, you might submit that dispute. You might be required to submit that dispute to arbitration in order to work out, your disagreement with the user. And, in fact, you might want to have an alternate dispute resolution process to deal with your online dispute, especially if the person is in a remote jurisdiction and you don't want to, be worried about, bringing a lawsuit and on the other side of the world against this other user. So I think the companies have an incentive, to some extent, to try to create their own rules and enforcement procedures for these online worlds.
To what extent is online reputation kind of a self-policing aspect of all of this?
Well, the online reputation of the user, I think, can be important in many forms. I think there's an interesting question, I think, in virtual worlds about the online reputation of the avatar as opposed to the online reputation of the user of the avatar. What's interesting is, in some of these virtual worlds, people think of their avatars as importantly separate from their real-world identities, and their reputation might be distinct in the virtual world. They might want to avoid kind of attaching their real identity to their avatar identity. So that's an interesting aspect of this, I think, for virtual worlds. For other platforms like Facebook or for eBay, for instance, there's a strong correlation, and the companies try to ensure this, between the offline identity and the online identity. And people have an interest in managing their reputation, and the companies, I think, have benefit from actually establishing reputations key to individual identities online. So So I think it can be very important, online reputation, just like it is in the offline world. The problem is, I guess, is that with online services, anonymity is more of a concern. When people can be anonymous, they might choose to, and they might choose to do things that they wouldn't do without that kind of impersonal anonymity that you can have on the internet.
What is the state of the law at the moment in terms of determining jurisdiction in the online world?
Well, it's really an evolution of what we've had in the past. So we've had telephones for a while, and individuals call each other on the telephone and sometimes enter into business agreements, and one person's in one jurisdiction, another person's in another. And there's a question, you know, of whether or not there are sufficient contacts with the remote jurisdiction to warrant, like the remote jurisdiction subjecting the other party to the law of the jurisdiction they're contacting. So the general rule, and it's established by the Due Process Clause in the Constitution, is you can't bring someone into your forum and decide a case against them unless they've had minimum contacts with your jurisdiction. So that's the general rule in the United States. What is interesting about that, I think, is that what you're seeing with increasing, you know, frequency of remote interactions. So a person, you know, in Pennsylvania might, using eBay, might do a transaction with a person in Alaska just as easily as they might do a transaction with a neighbor. If we have the rule that you need to have sufficient contacts with the jurisdiction, and the person in Alaska didn't actually target the person in Pennsylvania, for instance, then you have a situation where there might not be any real legal remedy for the person in Pennsylvania except to travel to Alaska and sue there. Given the cost of doing that, it means that the person might not choose to sue unless there's a whole lot of money on the table, in which case we have the absence of any kind of real legal remedy for that person for smaller stake transactions. So that leads to, I think, hopefully an increasing interest in the online service providers in creating some kind of dispute resolution procedure that actually operates outside traditional law or kind of in addition to traditional law.
In this gaming world, how much money are we talking about?
Well, there was a space station recently bought. I think it's a record amount of over $300,000 for a space station in this world of Project Entropia. But I think most players were talking about $1,000 or less in terms of their virtual assets if they were to turn around and sell them on an online auction. But some people have substantial investments, and you could see, you know, it's not unusual for people to have you know, accounts with assets worth, you know, $10,000 in some of these online worlds.
Has anybody tried to make the case that time is also an asset, that somebody has an investment of time in these worlds?
Yeah, I've seen that argument being made, and it's certainly true. People do have substantial investments of time. Some of these online worlds, you know, the players will play for 30 hours a week, you know, on average. So it's not unusual to have people that are deeply committed in terms of time. Turning that into a legal claim, saying you have a property interest in your time, is a lot more tenuous, I think. I haven't seen any courts actually accept the idea that you have a property interest in the time that you spent playing one of these online games.
How have the courts looked at all of this so far?
Well, I think they defer, like I said, to the terms of service to a great deal. So the online contract that you sign is going to be actually very important to your legal rights in the virtual world. So it's important to read that, even though most people don't. If you're concerned about, you know, a potential legal dispute, you should definitely take a look at that. Even if you're not, I think it's a good idea to take a look at that. But I think courts are generally concerned about situations where they see some kind of injustice and they say, you know, well, if the contract is actually too lopsided, too one-sided, favoring the platform owner against the user, and they sense some kind of injustice is going on, they might say that the contract is unenforceable and want to reach the issue. That's what the court did with regard to the Bragg case. It said that an arbitration provision that required Bragg to travel to California in order to work things out with the Linden Lab, they said it was too expensive and too lopsided in favor of the Second Life owners to be enforceable. So it allowed the case to proceed in federal court.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that there really is going to have to be some kind of federal jurisdiction over because of the fact that it takes place in so many places?
I think, yeah, to a large extent. When you see things on the Internet, you're going to see federal legislation being preferred to state legislation. That doesn't mean that states are not going to have their own laws that are going to be relevant to this, especially California, I think, is going to create some, you know, it has created some important state laws that affect basically the way the entire country does business, given the prevalence of Internet-based, you know, industries in Silicon Valley, et cetera. So I think we're going to see state law still continue to be important, but I think, like you just said, I think federal jurisdiction makes a lot more sense. And to a certain extent, I think, you know, given the fact that some of these companies operate from, you know, foreign jurisdictions, some kind of international consensus on virtual law might be wise.
How does online gambling fit into this equation?
Well, that's a good question. There's a potential distinction here, I think, between gambling that is chance based and gambling that is skill based. And you see some differences in the legal regulation of chance based gambling, like slot machines, right, versus skill based activities, games, more like, you know, something involving your skill and your time, a kind of contest-based activity. So there's a question here about whether these online worlds, when you acquire property, when you make new things, is this a game or is it not a game? And if it's characterized as a game and there's a chance element to it, then it seems an awful lot like gambling. So gambling regulations could apply to some of these online worlds. But jurisdictions are struggling with this. The jurisdictions that are actually taking this seriously, for instance, in South Korea, they do make a distinction between virtual worlds that they regard as games that are akin to gambling and virtual worlds that are like contests or the like kind of ordinary social spheres where players are creative and there's not a large element of chance in the activity. So I think, you know, that there is a concern about that, and there's certainly, you know, have been situations. Second Life, for instance, used to have a lot of gambling establishments in its virtual world, and then legal concerns about the legal reality of gambling for virtual currency and the conversion of virtual currency to real cash, I think, led them to create a ban on gambling in Second Life. But this is something that's going to be coming up, I think, increasingly in virtual worlds.
Is it all self-reporting, or is there any kind of law enforcement effort to police this on an ongoing basis?
Well, that's a good question, too. I was just talking, actually, with a group of people involved in criminal investigations of virtual worlds. And I think they're a little bit, you know, concerned about the potential here for instance, money laundering, or the use of these platforms as an alternative to the use of traditional phone lines or computer networks in order to avoid surveillance. But there's also, you know, concern about the potential for this to be a magnet for crime and for malicious software. So, for instance, there's a virus that's very prevalent right now, and what the virus does is essentially steals passwords to virtual worlds. And then the people that created the virus use the passwords to get onto the virtual worlds, to acquire the virtual assets, the virtual property of the owner of the password, and then to sell them online for real money. And because there's a lot of ambiguity about whether or not a person actually has a property interest in the virtual currency that they have, you know, in their account, and many of the terms of service say that they don't have an interest in their virtual currency, this is a pretty, you know, lucrative kind of enticing crime, because if there really is no harm done to the user by having their account depleted of virtual property, but there's real profit involved, well, this seems to be, you know, a good opportunity for virtual criminals to have a heyday. So there is a concern, I think, about the criminal potential of these environments, even beyond just the existence of a new kind of technological platform for conducting normal criminal activities.
Mm-hmm. What is the role of technology so far in being able to monitor all of this?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting issue as well. I think law enforcement is struggling with its efforts to attempt, you know, to surveil and keep track of electronic communications generally. There are concerns, I think, by law enforcement officials that some of these new platforms, you know, the Facebooks out there, are not as easily monitored as traditional phone lines, where you can get a wiretap order or figure out other ways to conduct surveillance. So there's a concern about that, and I think there's some people out there that are interested in building kind of more back doors in order to enable surveillance of these environments as well. So, but privacy advocates, of course, are justifiably concerned, I think, about having too much, you know, intrusion. And with virtual worlds, I think it's very interesting in that people have a sense that what they do in virtual worlds may be private. So if your avatar seems to be in a secluded space, you might think, well, nobody's watching me, nobody's around. But that's just a simulation. In fact, everything that you're doing is being recorded and logged in a virtual world all the time. So what people's expectations are of privacy in virtual worlds may differ from the way the technology actually operates.
And how has all of this concern impacted the designers of these games?
Well, I think they're understandably concerned. They are in the role of creating products, you know, and competing in the market for entertainment. Well, I mean, some of the games are kind of traditional video games, but they're created as networked games, multiplayer games. So they have, you know, significant business challenges just in, you know, competing in that entertainment market. They don't want to, I think, take on the role of being a new government online. And they don't want to take on the role of being an intermediary in legal disputes. And I think that's why they craft their end-user license agreements and terms of service the way they do. They want to keep legal problems to a minimum, like any business does. However, when they have users interacting with each other on these platforms and having real monetary investments on their platforms, they inevitably end up in the role of being a kind of virtual police, you know, for user disputes and having to create these rules. So I think they're being almost unwillingly drawn into the role of being a dispute mediator, and it's part of their customer service burden. But I think if they would, you know, they don't want to become their own virtual jurisdictions, and to a certain extent they're being dragged into that role involuntarily.
Mm-hmm. Are there certain games that have become more hotbeds, if you will, for this kind of illegal activity?
Well, you know, and again, illegal might be too strong a word. Questionable, concerning, troubling activity.
Questionable, yes.
Right. So the games that are more open platforms, and I think this is actually too bad in a way, but when you create a game that enables people to have a great deal of creative control over the environment, where there are minimal rules and where there's maximum kind of user creativity, those are the virtual worlds that are going to be more likely to get into legal problems, actually. Because in an environment where users have few choices and everything's kind of scripted and there's very little user control over the environment, well, then they can be, you know, monitored, you know, and controlled fairly effectively, and especially when there's, you know, rather low investments, so people aren't paying much for virtual property. I think Second Life has had its share of legal headaches because it created a virtual world where people had, you know, extreme powers of creativity. They could basically create the entire world on their own and shape their avatars any way that they wanted to. And they wanted to create a platform for commerce, so people had incentives to create real investments in Second Life and to spend, you know, thousands of dollars on virtual land. Well, when people have, you know, a great deal of power over the technology and a great deal of investment in the platform, it's likely that this is going to be a situation that's going to be more rife, I think, for legal problems. So some of these virtual worlds, I think, have more legal issues than other virtual worlds, and part of it's due to the way the technology is designed.
In your experience, as you look around, to what extent are the courts beginning to understand the reality of this world? Because obviously you probably have an awful lot of people that don't have a clue as to what's going on in these worlds.
That's right. You know, and it reminds me of the 1990s and the internet. I think there was a stage there when courts were confronting claims about, you know, websites and the internet, and every court opinion that was issued would have a paragraph explaining what the internet was or what the World Wide Web was, and it seemed, you know, kind of a sense of wonderment on the part of these judges is confronting this new technology. And it took us, I think, you know, at least 10 years. To a certain extent, we're still dealing with judges kind of playing catch up with the technology. But I think culture is kind of now popular culture has embraced the internet, and we're all kind of aware, at least, of what the World Wide Web is. These are new, so I think
I don't know how many judges are playing Second Life.
No, I think it's going to be a while before we get judges that were raised in Second Life and that have an understanding of the way virtual worlds work. So I think we're due for at least a decade of courts kind of scratching their heads when they're looking at this conduct and trying to figure it out.
Greg Listoka, the book is Virtual Justice, The New Laws of Online Worlds, just out from Yale University Press. Greg, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thank you.